office, the war debt, including about $25 million in state debts, had reached $75 to $80 million, about $996 million in 2009 dollars. But in relatively short order, the founders got things back under control while they also built our reputation in the world. It was a precedent worthy of emulation and preservation, one that could keep strengthening and growing the Tree of Liberty for centuries to come. There were other people, however, who didn't appreciate those precedents. While they'd not yet been formalized into a group, they would eventually come to be known as progressives, and they had other plans for the Tree of Liberty. Unfortunately, they involved a saw. Teachable moment. Back in Washington's days, the federal government owed about $225 per citizen, adjusted to 2009 dollars. Today, $43,000 per person. If this were a game show where I could choose the government showcase or the cash, I'd take the cash. We are beginning a new era in our government. The national debt, which has so long been a burden on the Treasury, will be finally discharged in the course of the ensuing year. I cannot too strongly urge the necessity of a rigid economy and an inflexible determination not to enlarge the income beyond the real necessities of government and not to increase the wants of the government by unnecessary and profuse expenditures. Andrew Jackson. Chapter 4. The 19th Century. Old Hickory, Honest Abe, and Harpy Fangs. Don't let that stoic portrait on the face of a $20 bill fool you. Andrew Jackson knew how to throw a party. At his inauguration, Old Hickory's raucous band of supporters got so sloshed and wild that they smashed thousands of dollars of fine china and glassware and tracked a trail of muddy footprints all over the White House. The party got so out of control that Jackson had his servants haul the liquor out onto the White House lawn just to get everyone out so a cleaning crew could get to work. Starting off in administration with such a costly bash, at least before it was fashionable to do so, might seem to portend bad things for Andrew Jackson's financial stewardship, but nothing could be further from the truth. Jackson despised debt so much that in 1824 he called it a national curse that helped destroy individual liberty in favor of the elites. Today, that lesson has mostly been lost. Even in the face of increasing joblessness, stagnant incomes, and a deteriorating economy, our leaders view debt as a national blessing that can cure all of society's ills. Unfortunately, forgetting the lessons of the past doesn't invalidate them. History always wins in the end. Old Hickory's word, strong as oak. Jackson, who was born poor and then orphaned by the American Revolution, staked his political career on a single promise to the nation. My vow shall be to pay the national debt, to prevent a moneyed aristocracy from growing up around our administration that must bend to its views, and ultimately destroy the liberty of our country. That promise didn't work out for him during his first run for president in 1824. He lost. But he continued to live by it after his eventual election. In many ways, America's seventh president was merely parroting the views of his predecessors. For example, the two presidents before him, John Quincy Adams and James Monroe, had both started a trend toward paying off the debt. Jackson's pledge to do the same, despite how radical it may sound today, was really nothing new. Except for waging wars or buying land, presidents throughout much of the 19th century continued the anti-frivolous spending views of our founders. Even with that extraordinarily restrictive view on using debt, America still managed to expand and grow. Louisiana was purchased, payments were made for Alaska, the Gadsden Purchase, and the land acquired in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, Arizona, New Mexico, and parts of Utah, California, Nevada, and Colorado. Railroads and canals were starting to rapidly expand, though back then it was private industry that led the way, not the government. Heck, the country even fought a brutal, bloody, and expensive civil war. But again, even with these war expenditures and serious capital investments in land and transportation, the mindset never shifted. Debt, even when deemed necessary, was the enemy. Beyond his own impoverished childhood, Jackson had developed a lifelong hatred of aristocracy that stemmed from an event that occurred during the Revolutionary War. While being held as a prisoner of war, Old Hickory was ordered to shine a British officer's boots. He refused. The officer slashed at him with his sword, and while Jackson was able to ward off the worst of the blow, his left arm was cut to the bone and his head was gashed open. Suffice it to say that that encounter didn't exactly leave him with a warm and fuzzy feeling about English aristocracy. After he was orphaned, Jackson's views on economics began to take hold. He came to see the accumulation of debt as simply another way to slowly wreak havoc on the rights of man. A supporter of Jackson once called the idea of mounting public debt harpy fangs. While he was referring to Greek mythology, nerd alert, harpies were winged bird women with fangs and claws who continually snatched away the food from blind Phineas when he tried to eat. I have a modern-day interpretation. Debt slowly sucks the lifeblood out of a republic, all while beautiful harps play a melody in the background. You are so happy and content with all of the free stuff being handed out that you don't realize you will soon be dead. As 1834 drew to a close, Jackson had accomplished a feat few thought possible. He had paid off the national debt. "Free from public debt," the president wrote, "at peace with all the world. The present may be hailed as the epoch in our history, the most favorable for the settlement of those principles in our domestic policy which shall be best calculated to give stability to our republic and secure the blessings of freedom to our citizens." How did he do it? Well, surely it must have been through major tax increases, likely on the wealthiest 1%. That, as we all now know, is really the only way to turn things around, right? Strangely, no. Jackson found another way. Instead of new taxes, tariffs, and regulations, he did the opposite. He let entrepreneurs innovate and free markets work. As a result, the American economy grew, virtually free from government interference. The lesson from history is clear. The best way out of debt isn't to grow taxes. It's to grow the tax base. Brother bankrupting brother. Unfortunately, the stability to our republic that Jackson gloated about soon came face to face with the Civil War. Economically, fighting wars is like gaining weight. Once you start, it's hard to stop. Dieting might help temporarily, but you hardly ever get back down to the weight you were before. Once you start packing on the pounds again, you are starting from a higher weight than last time, thereby creating a vicious cycle that's impossible to get out of without a radical change in lifestyle. War spending is the same way. Each time we fight, we rack up a massive amount of new debt. Even when we subsequently cut spending, it's rare that we ever do enough to pay off the cost of the war. Therefore, the next major spending item or war simply adds to the previously bloated total, and so on. The only way to stop the cycle is to take a completely radical approach to our finances. And radical isn't a word that is in the vocabulary of most politicians, except those working at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, though they have a much different vision for radical than most of us do. Before the Civil War, the United States government had never spent more in a single year than $74.2 million in 1858 dollars. Since the Civil War, however, America has never spent less than $236.9 million, which occurred in 1878. In 1865 alone, with the war ending and the occupation of the South beginning, we spent $1.297 billion, the first time in history that any nation ever had a billion-dollar budget. At the start of the Civil War, on April 15, 1861, the federal government was pumping about $172,000 a day into the war effort, $4 million a day in 2009 dollars. By year's end, that number had climbed to $1.5 million a day. The federal government was hemorrhaging cash at historic levels, yet the war was still being funded largely through domestic financing. Abraham Lincoln's Treasury Secretary, Salmon P. Chase, who would later go on to serve as Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, felt strongly that the Union had benefited from the fact that the debt had previously been paid off, which gave the country a strong credit history. He pledged that over time, the new mountains of debt would likewise be whittled away. To accomplish that goal, Chase brought back a financing concept pioneered during the Revolution. Instead of simply selling bonds to bankers, he offered them to ordinary citizens as well. Chase did that by breaking the bonds up into denominations as small as $50 to be paid in monthly installments. The move laid the foundation for the future sales of war bonds during the First and Second World Wars, a source of financing that was critical to our success. But perhaps more important, Chase's public financing tactic successfully raised two-thirds of the Union's revenues, thereby ensuring that citizens who supported the war effort would pay for it themselves instead of passing the buck to future generations. That fits squarely into Lincoln's view that debt held by American citizens was far preferred to debt held by foreign powers. The great advantage of citizens being creditors as well as debtors with relation to the public debt is obvious, Lincoln said in his 1864 address to Congress. Men can readily perceive that they cannot be much oppressed by a debt which they owe to themselves. That concept may have been obvious back then, but it's pretty obscure now. We no longer seem to care who buys our debt, so long as the rates stay low and the money keeps flowing. Still, the military money machine whirred on. By May 1864, the Navy and War Departments were shelling out about $2 million a day, which matched the entire amount the government was raising. But Lincoln, like Thomas Jefferson before him, knew firsthand the perils of personal debt. His failed business ventures had left him to conclude that debt was the greatest obstacle I have ever met in my life, and he didn't want that same impediment to be put in the way of his country. Republicans pledged fiscal responsibility, but someone always has to pay. In this case, it was decided that the debts were too large for spending cuts alone. Sound familiar? So in August 1861, America passed its first income tax. Salmon Chase pushed it through Congress, saying that a tax of 10 or even 20% on all incomes is better than the rapid accumulation of national debt and the rapid deterioration of the national credit. But there was some good news, at least for a little while. Chase's proposed tax rates were much higher than what actually passed. Middle-class earners had to pay a whopping 3% on income of about $800. Those who made more than $10,000 got creamed with a gigantic 5%. And any greedy capitalist who dared to create jobs for others and earned above $10,000 was taxed at the criminally astronomical rate of, ready for this? 10%. We could joke about how this was quite the Obama-style redistributionist policy, but as we've now discovered, the joke was really on us. Like almost all progressive policies, this was nothing but a starter home, a bare-bones structure that could be expanded and developed over the years until the end result, a progressive income tax with rates that once went as high as 91%, looked nothing like the original. A lot more on that later. The lesson to take from this is that the national income tax began as an extreme measure authorized to pay for an extreme and thankfully rare occurrence, a civil war. And yet, even then, given the dire and essential nature of the cause before them, America's leaders did not use the crisis to saddle future generations with debt. Instead, they soaked the rich by taking a dime for every buck a wealthy person earned. Teachable moment. Instead of ensuring that Americans own the debt, 90% of our War of 1812 debt was held by citizens, we've invited foreign investors in with open arms. As a result, only an estimated 60% of our current national debt is held by U.S. entities, thereby leaving the country wide open to the very oppression that Lincoln was concerned about. I say estimated because, as the Congressional Budget Office points out, we really don't know. The numbers are imperfect, a fact that should concern all of us. The printing press and politicians, a match made in hell. Given the size of the debt that had been incurred, it soon became obvious that even a new income tax wouldn't be enough. So, to fund the war, the North passed the Legal Tender Act of 1862 and started printing $450 million worth of greenbacks, so named because of the color of the ink that was used. These notes were not backed by gold, but were instead legal tender notes backed by the full faith and credit of the federal government. It was a novel concept, but Treasury Secretary Chase hated the idea. He knew that printing money not backed by a hard asset would eventually trigger inflation. Inflated paper currency, he said, was a great evil and should be reformed as soon as possible. But, as before, the war effort took priority. Concerns over inflating took a backseat to concerns over existing, and Chase reluctantly agreed to the act. Like any good politician, Chase, of course, tried to make lemonade out of lemons by putting a picture of himself on the new bill, sort of a miniature political ad in your wallet, in the hope of boosting his name recognition enough to become president one day. Spoiler alert, it didn't work. While it's often forgotten in history, before this period of government money, state banks were the norm. These were actually private banks chartered by individual states. As part of their charters, banks were permitted to print their own money, or notes, with the value being guaranteed by a gold, silver, or specie reserve. Because no bank can survive if it keeps a 100% reserve, each bank would try to judge how many notes would be redeemed for specie on a given day, and would keep that amount on hand. Typically, that was between 6 and 10% of all the outstanding notes. As is the case today, a bank's reserves are really only part of the reason it is successful. Trust is the other. It wasn't the gold that backed the notes, but faith. The reserve ratio was more of a test of that faith than any real economic measure that people cared about. During times of panic, people would run to banks to exchange their notes for specie. The problem, of course, is that banks didn't have enough to fulfill everyone's orders, so they would occasionally stop converting notes. This was called suspending, and while it was prohibited by the bank's charters, there wasn't much that anyone could do if all banks did it at once. Remember, most of the banks during this time were not actually insolvent. They were simply unable to handle a run on their reserves, much like the banks of today. The key difference between these charter banks and today's banks is that the notes they issued would compete openly in the marketplace against other notes. If a particular bank had a poor reputation, their notes might be worth less, or not accepted by the public at all. How did you know if a note was worth the $5 printed on it? For that, people turned to something called Dillaston's Banknote Reporter, which reported the prices of all known money and was used extensively. Any money trading at more than 1% below par value was considered to not be trustworthy, and people would avoid it. Naturally, if you were a businessman and someone wanted to pay you in money you didn't trust, you would discount it and demand a higher price for the risk. These days, there is no competition in money. A dollar is a dollar, regardless of the fact that very little in the way of gold, silver, or other hard assets actually backs up that value. Competitive money was a very effective and stable system for many years. What ended it? The government's involvement, of course. After printing the $450 million in greenbacks and chartering a slew of new national banks, each with authority to print money, the state banks had to go. The federal government passed a new 10% tax on all non-national currency, i.e., notes issued by state-chartered banks, effectively giving an unfair advantage to the national banks and driving the private ones out of business. It's not hard to find that same kind of mentality today. Large international banks are bailed out because they are too big to fail, while small local banks, you know, the ones that don't have big lobbying budgets, are left to fend for themselves. Go government! The war's toll, physically, mentally, and financially. Numerous historians have recounted the emotional and psychological toll that the four-year-long whirlwind of human carnage took on Lincoln personally. By the war's end, hundreds of thousands of citizens had been slaughtered and countless more injured or widowed. The cost in blood and treasure is hard for modern Americans to comprehend. And Lincoln knew it was all on him. The death, the debt, the devastation to the nation's land and infrastructure, all of it bore his fingerprints. "War, at the best, is terrible," Lincoln said in a June 1864 speech in Philadelphia. "And this war of ours, in its magnitude and in its duration, is one of the most terrible. It has deranged business, totally in many localities, and partially in all localities. It has destroyed property and ruined homes. It has produced a national debt and taxation unprecedented." What made Lincoln the iconic leader he was, however, was his ability to recognize that these painful, indeed excruciating, human and financial costs were still worth it. The Union hung in the balance. Slavery's fate, too. Only stakes of that moral magnitude, Lincoln believed, could justify the kind of debt that, at the time, seemed unthinkable. Of course, Lincoln, for all his wonderful characteristics, was still a politician. He knew the debt was large, but necessary, and so he did what all good politicians do. He started up the spin machine. "A debt of $600 million now," he explained, "is a less sum per head than was the debt of our revolution when we came out of that struggle. And the money value in the country now bears even a greater proportion to what it was then than does the population. Surely each man has strong motive now to preserve our liberties as each had then to establish them." Lincoln's comments, while likely intended to alleviate concern among citizens, also reveal that he, like Jackson, understood the power and importance of economic growth as a method of paying down debt. As he explained, a rapidly growing population meant more cash for the Treasury to collect, and therefore each person's share of the overall debt came down. But, even with that understanding, Lincoln knew that future growth couldn't be used as a crutch. "It's no excuse," he said, "for delaying payment on the nation's bills." But Abe's admirable attitude aside, the national debt he had amassed was a colossus. In October 1865, Secretary of Treasury Hugh McCulloch announced that the national debt stood at $2.8 billion, dwarfing anything America had ever seen before. As historian Jay Sexton noted, the debt's previous high had been in 1815, when it stood at $127 million thanks to the War of 1812. These were jaw-dropping and daunting debts, and the American people were not accustomed to them. The nation was now spending 42 times more than it had spent just 6 years earlier, an amount equal to about half of the country's entire gross national product. In 1865, the Republicans passed a resolution in honor of Lincoln. "Resolved, that the national faith, pledged for the redemption of the public debt, must be kept inviolate, and that for this purpose, we recommend economy and rigid responsibility in the public expenditures." I'll pause here for a second so you can stop laughing. ADD moment. The logic that population growth decreases the amount of debt per head, as Lincoln put it, is something that we're probably going to hear a lot about in the years ahead. With demographics working against them, politicians won't be focused on organic population growth. They'll be focused on growth via immigration. In other words, you are very likely to hear the argument that some kind of amnesty program for illegal aliens is the magic bullet to getting our national debt under control. Two progressive birds, one stone. Even in the absence of Treasury Secretary Chase, the Democratic and Republican presidents who were elected after the Civil War remained committed to championing his method of getting citizens to pony up small amounts of cash for bonds. And lots of Americans did. By 1880, 71,587 individuals directly owned registered government bonds, a fairly significant number given that the population back then was only about 50 million. But still not rising to the heights of patriotic debt ownership seen during the Revolution. A team effort. Fortunately for America, which was still finding its sea legs, the 19th century presidents who followed Lincoln were largely committed to chipping away at the nation's massive debt. Their political affiliations didn't matter. Andrew Johnson, who was part of the National Union Party, though routinely considered to be a Democrat, cut the debt by $100 million, even though he spent $7.2 million buying Alaska in 1867. Ulysses S. Grant, a Republican, came next. Aided by his fiscally conservative Treasury Secretary, who was fanatically devoted to reducing the national debt and establishing a hard currency, Grant managed to reduce the debt further, down to $2.2 billion, a cut of $500 million. The next four presidents, Hayes, Garfield, and Arthur, all Republicans, and Cleveland, a Democrat, all pitched in to work the debt down to $1.6 billion by 1892, a full 43% below the level it was at in 1865. During his inaugural address, Garfield said, "By the experience of commercial nations in all ages, it has been found that gold and silver afford the only safe foundation for a monetary system." Odds we ever hear that in another inaugural address? 10 million to 1. All told, America ran surpluses for 28 straight years following the Civil War. By 1900, the war debt had almost been paid off entirely, and by 1916, the total national debt stood at $1.2 billion, a full 56% below its high. While the debt hadn't been completely eliminated, this was still a true bipartisan victory, a powerful testament to the fact that Democrats and Republicans, while having different priorities, all agreed that debt was kryptonite to the America of their dreams. But as our nation entered the 20th century, that bipartisan agreement was about to come to a screeching halt.
"Remember that God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States. Neither you nor any other mortal or mortals could have prevented this." Woodrow Wilson. Chapter 5. America's Debt Progresses the Wrong Way. Woodrow Wilson represents many things to many people. To leftists, he's a patron saint, one of the holy fathers of progressivism. To liberal academics, he's a hero, the first and only U.S. president to hold both a Ph.D. and serve as president of a major university. Princeton, you know. And to me, he's the guy I hate. He's a man who did more damage to the fabric of America than anyone else who has ever come before or after. To understand how America changed from a country devoted to faith, family, and frugality to a country devoted to freebies, you have to first understand the progressive movement and how it has been working to destroy the bedrock that America was built on.
Progressives Against Progress. On March 21, 1915, President Woodrow Wilson held a White House screening of the infamous KKK movie, The Birth of a Nation, which was based on the best-selling book, The Klansman. After watching the racist flick, Woodrow Wilson, son of a Confederate chaplain, allegedly offered a sterling endorsement. "It is like writing history with lightning," Wilson has been quoted as saying, "and my only regret is that it is all so terribly true." Teachable moment. Did Wilson really give that sterling endorsement of a clearly racist movie? I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure, but there is a pretty lively debate about it online. Many cite evidence of quotes that appeared in papers attributing those words to Wilson, while others say that the endorsement was made up by the filmmakers who were looking to get publicity. To be safe, let's just assume he never said it. After all, why hate Woodrow Wilson for his racism when there are so many other good reasons to hate him? The film became one of the Ku Klux Klan's greatest pieces of membership propaganda ever. Millions signed up to wear pointy white hoods and hate black people. And, at least according to Civil War historian James McPherson, an emeritus professor at Princeton, Woodrow Wilson, one of progressivism's greatest heroes, deserves much of the credit. Wilson did see that film, McPherson said. It was screened in the White House for him, and he did endorse it. I think his impact on the revival of the Klan and on the popularity of that movement, no matter what he later said, was important. Such a stinging indictment from one of America's greatest historians, and one who taught at Wilson's own Princeton University, no less, should come as little surprise. For those who care to notice, Wilson's bigotry is well documented. He fired 15 of 17 black supervisors who had been appointed to federal jobs and replaced them with whites. He slashed ambassadorships to Haiti and Santo Domingo that had traditionally gone to blacks and gave them to whites. He even issued executive orders to the Treasury Department and Postmaster General to segregate the departments. Yes, the left's holy father was indeed a bigot, albeit a very educated bigot. Of course, Wilson was hardly the first progressive to not hold African Americans in high regard. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, showed his true colors during the 1906 Brownsville incident. The 25th Infantry Regiment, which was made up entirely of black troops who'd served America honorably in prior conflicts, was relocated to Brownsville, Texas. The townspeople there didn't appreciate the move, thinking it would upset the racial harmony. One night, a small riot broke out, resulting in the murder of a bartender and injuries to a police officer. The soldiers became immediate suspects. After questioning and a long investigation, no charges were brought, but all 167 troops, six of whom were Medal of Honor recipients, were recommended to be discharged without honor. Blacks across America were understandably outraged, but Roosevelt did nothing. In fact, it was worse than that. Roosevelt did nothing until after the congressional election was over, hoping to secure as much of the black vote as possible. Only then did he sign an order discharging all 167 troops from service, denying them back pay, and canceling their pensions. When Senator Joseph Foraker of Ohio proposed a bill to allow them to re-enlist, Roosevelt denied the effort and turned Foraker into an enemy. In later years, it became obvious that the soldiers had been framed and that Roosevelt helped ruin the reputations of innocent, honorable men. 66 years after the incident, Richard Nixon signed a bill to correct the historical record and give the 167 men honorable discharges. But Teddy Roosevelt's record will stand forever. I'm better than you. Wilson's bigotry was merely one dimension of his cancerous progressive policies and his elitist persona. In the great tradition of academic leftists, Woodrow Wilson was a supreme narcissist, a man convinced that he was of a superior stock and breed than others, a man with a severe God complex. Remember, he told William McCombs, head of the Democratic National Committee, that God ordained that I should be the next president of the United States. Neither you nor any other mortal or mortals could have prevented this. What made Woodrow Wilson especially dangerous was that he had taken the faith of his Presbyterian minister father and his mother, the daughter of a Presbyterian minister, and mixed it with a lust for power, leavened with a heaping dollop of socialism. In fact, in his own writings, Wilson made no secret about his fixation with power. In his book, Congressional Power, Wilson wrote, "I cannot imagine power as a thing negative and not positive." Apparently, atrocities at the hands of dictatorial governments and regimes never crossed his mind, even as the country suffered through a world war. Wilson saw government as a new god, a vehicle through which power could and should be delivered. Writing in his book ominously titled The State, Wilson declared, "Government does now whatever experience permits or the times demand." He also mocked what he called the 4th of July sentiments of those patriotic dolts who actually believed in the governing philosophy of our founders. No doubt a lot of nonsense has been talked about the inalienable rights of the individual, Wilson sneered, and a great deal that was mere vague sentiment and pleasing speculation has been put forward as fundamental principle. All these progressive impulses spoke to a view of government radically different than what any of his predecessors in the White House had held. Progressives believed that government was a means by which they could implement the social engineering that Wilson found preferable by enacting policies designed to redeem the masses. "Government is not a machine, but a living thing," Wilson wrote in Congressional Government. "It falls not under the Newtonian theory of the universe, but under the Darwinian theory of organic life." Expanding the size and scope of the state was, therefore, a natural process, a reflection of the evolving times and the enactment of the social gospel, which was the use of religion as rationale for solving many social problems. In this way, taxes were not about simply raising revenue. Rather, they were a means of punishing the wealthy for the sin of greed and accumulation, thereby creating equality in income. Wilson didn't usher in progressivism alone. He had lots of help. His Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, took the attitude that the wealthy must be punished for their affluence. If New York and Massachusetts pay more tax under this law than other states, it will be because they have more taxable incomes within their borders. And why should not those sections pay most which enjoy most? Education was another conduit for spreading the social gospel and progressivism. Amassing children together was a great way to not simply educate, but also to transform a new generation of Americans, prompting liberals like John Dewey to call for a new public education system. "Our problem is not merely to help the students to adjust themselves to world life," said Wilson, "but to make them as unlike their fathers as we can." This sort of moral emancipation should have come as little surprise. In the 1912 election, Wilson ran on the theme of a second struggle for emancipation and the need for a new freedom. One of the main obstacles in his path, of course, was that rigid, narrow, cumbersome document, the United States Constitution. Fortunately for Wilson, he had that direct line to God. "Living political constitutions must be Darwinian in structure and in practice," he explained. "Society is a living organism and must obey the laws of life. It must develop. All that progressives ask or desire is permission to interpret the Constitution according to the Darwinian principle." Put simply, Wilson believed that all that was needed to usher in the radical social engineering he envisioned to create his utopia was for Americans to abandon their blind devotion to the Constitution. If he could convince the public to do that, all manners of hell could be unleashed. But first, he had to champion the idea that the people behind the Constitution, our founders, were short-sighted. Sure, they may have been brilliant for their time, but things were different now. "While we are followers of Jefferson," he said, "there is one principle of Jefferson's which no longer can obtain in the practical politics of America. You know that it was Jefferson who said that the best government is that which does as little governing as possible, but that time is past. America is not now and cannot in the future be a place for unrestricted individual enterprise." You can almost hear the hinge of history swinging backward, away from everything that our forefathers stood for, fought for, and died for in that one quote. It was a pivot of epic proportions, and it paved the way for unprecedented sums of money to be spent on a buffet of social engineering projects designed to control, elevate, and alter the human condition. A hostile takeover of religion. The kind of perfected condition that progressive thinkers envisioned can be clearly seen in the works of Herbert Crowley, founder of the liberal magazine The New Republic. Crowley said that progressives believed a better future would derive from the beneficent activities of expert social engineers who would bring to the service of social ideals all the technical resources which research could discover and ingenuity could devise. He wanted to join forces with the ideologists of Christ so they could plan and effect a redeeming transformation of society. Yes, it sounds creepy, because it is. By piggybacking on the language of religion, the progressives gave themselves moral superiority over anyone who disagreed. Taxes became a metaphorical form of tithing to the government, which would then launch missions to evangelize and spread the social gospel. It also gave progressives convenient cover for inflicting massive taxes on those who had prospered, which they spun as a clear sign of sinful gain. As William Jennings Bryan put it, "Would it not be fairer for the gentleman to fling his burnished lance full in the face of the toiler, and not plead for the great fortunes of this country under the cover of a poor man's name?" Another component of the progressive social gospel involved contorting Jesus' biblical commands to individuals by turning them into edicts and responsibilities for governments to carry out. Ironically, even though many progressives who advocated the social gospel did not actually believe Scripture was literal, they nonetheless supported what they saw as a Christian society based on the social gospel. In other words, they supported the Scriptures when it supported them. One important early proponent of the social gospel was Washington Gladden, a progressive congregational minister from Ohio. As he explained to his followers, socialism was little more than what he called applied Christianity, and it was applied by using the coercive power of the state, not by individuals and congregations choosing to live out and act on their beliefs. Others, such as Henry Vedder, author of the book Socialism and the Ethics of Jesus, held that Christ was the great leveler, not just spiritually, but in material terms. And Walter Rauschenbusch, a leading proponent of the social gospel and the author of A Theology of the Social Gospel, explained that the social gospel constitutes the moral power in the propaganda of socialism. With the new social gospel framework and lingo in place, the social engineers went right to work. Every inch of human life and activity was on the table and up for governmental improvement. Even seemingly trivial policies, such as dictating to farmers how best to water their crops, became a component of their social engineering mission. Wilson's desire to control got so creepy that at one point he decided to create a new standard of manhood for American soldiers. The result was a commission on training camp activities that regulated everything from approved soldier recreation to sexual practices, promising protection and stimulation of its mental, moral, and physical manhood. Wilson didn't want to leave any stone of human responsibility unturned. The government, he said, needed to regulate business and trade, care for the poor and incapable, invoke sumptuary laws, educate the masses, enforce prohibition, on and on it went. What America really needed was a middle ground between individualism and socialism, because, Wilson said, modern individualism has much about it that is hateful, too hateful to last. Of course, like any good salesman, it's what Wilson didn't say that was most important. If individualism lasted, then his agenda could not. But progressivism worked, didn't it? Now that you have a background on how Wilson and other progressives saw the world, it's easier to understand how they used this view to set the country on a course toward economic ruin. When Wilson entered office in 1913, America was in strong fiscal shape. Balanced budgets were the norm. In 1916, U.S. debt amounted to just 2.54% of GNP. Then, Wilson got his agenda cranked up. The role and size of government exploded, and so did our budget. From 1916 to 1919, total federal expenditures rose 2,494%, and the national debt went from $3.6 billion to a whopping $27.4 billion. World War I, of course, played a role in this expansion, but like any good progressive, Wilson did not let a serious crisis go to waste. Instead of temporary spending or taxes, as had been the norm, remember, Salmon Chase had pushed through an income tax to fund the troops during the Civil War. Wilson pushed through legislation that would continually expand government without an expiration date. On October 3, 1913, Woodrow Wilson signed the Personal Income Tax Law. At its inception, 98% of American families were exempt. A normal rate of 1% was charged on incomes above $3,000, $4,000 for married couples. Above $20,000 in taxable income, however, rates began to rise until they reached 7% on incomes over $500,000. Relatively few American families were affected, as only 350,000 1040 forms were filed in 1914. By April 1917, with the war as an excuse, new changes were made to the income tax exemptions. The lowest tax threshold went from $3,000 down to $1,000, $2,000 for married couples. the normal tax rate was bumped up to 2%, and the top rate jumped to 67%, and then to 77% the following year. From 1917 to 1918, federal revenues went from $1.1 billion to $3.6 billion, an increase of 227%. And following the historical precedent of Americans paying for their wars, little public objection arose over the sharply raised taxes. But all that changed in 1920 when America's new progressive government lowered the financial hammer. The goal wasn't to collect more money. After all, as many progressives will even admit, the higher rates, then at 73% for the top bracket, didn't actually produce more revenue. The goal was a new concept in America: redistribution of the wealth. An analysis of the data reveals exactly what you'd expect in the face of insane tax rates. The wealthy simply shifted their income and sheltered their money. In 1916, when the tax rate for top earners was at 15%, the U.S. Treasury reported that there were 206 people in the United States who had million-dollar incomes. But by 1921, when the top tax rate was at a stratospheric 73%, only 21 people filed tax returns as millionaires. This proves one of two things. Either 90% of the country's millionaires went bankrupt or died, or millionaires are really, really good at dodging tax rates they consider to be too onerous. The same trend occurred with those earning between $300,000 and $1 million. In 1916, 1,090 returns were filed in that range, but by 1921, the number had plunged to 225. As Will Rogers once famously said, "The income tax has made more liars out of the American people than golf has." Progressive tax rates bucked the ideas of Adam Smith, who understood that such tax schemes were little more than a federal shakedown. As he put it in The Wealth of Nations, "When the rule of arithmetical proportion is broken, the door is open to extortion." Teachable moment. As David Houston, Wilson's last Secretary of the Treasury, put it, "It seems idle to speculate in the abstract as to whether or not a progressive income tax schedule rising to rates in excess of 70% is justifiable. We are confronted with a condition, not a theory. The fact is that such rates cannot be successfully collected." The backlash. As often happens when people see the effects of really bad policies, there was a modest return to America's traditional views about debt and the limited roles of government in Wilson's disastrous wake. The debit, which was over $27 billion in 1919, was reduced to $16 billion by 1930, largely due to the work of the presidents who followed Wilson, especially the notoriously frugal Calvin Coolidge. It's also worth noting that this reduction came at a time when it wasn't exactly fashionable to pay off debt. Many European nations defaulted on their war debt, leading Herbert Hoover in 1931 to declare a one-year moratorium on repayments. The United Kingdom, in fact, still owes America for World War I, and it's not a trivial amount, $74 billion in today's dollars. Andrew Mellon wrote in his book, Taxation, the People's Business, "Since the war, two guiding principles have dominated the financial policy of the government. One is balancing the budget, and the other is the payment of the public debt. Both are in line with the fundamental policy of the government since its beginning." You may want to add Mellon's book to your reading list, and send a copy to your representatives while you're at it. Unfortunately, progressive policies don't last for 4 or 8 years. They last forever. The income tax and new federal programs were stitched into our fabric, and they couldn't be removed easily. As Harvard professor Gardner Means put it, "Gradually but steadily, great segments of economic activity have been shifted from the marketplace to government administration." After 8 years of Woodrow Wilson's hyper-elitist progressive social engineering, the social gospel's seductions had done what they were designed to do: take power from individuals and hand it over to the planners, who are supposedly smarter, more enlightened, and more compassionate organizers of life for the masses. Worse, The idea that the Constitution was outdated and needed constant reinterpretation had produced a new intellectual spawn, the idea of a living Constitution, with tenets that are malleable and subjective. What's now known as the Progressive Era came to an end shortly after Wilson left office. In retrospect, we now understand what the progressives of that time didn't. It wasn't really an era at all, but a down payment on a much larger payoff still to come. Their movement didn't end. It just took a temporary hiatus so that Americans could forget how poorly those progressive ideas translated from theory to reality. What progressives needed to become relevant again was something that would shock the conscience of the public, something that would prove the evils of big business, the naivete of the founders, and the fallacy of capitalism all in one fell swoop. What they needed was a major crisis. And they were about to get one.
We seldom know 6 weeks in advance what we are going to do. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt explaining his administration's deft economic planning. Chapter 6. Hoover, Keynes, and FDR. The Three Horsemen of the Progressive Apocalypse. Sometimes a nation's mood can be heard in its popular music. In October 1929, the stock market crashed, but that soon seemed to be nothing more than a minor hiccup. Unemployment rose and peaked at 9%. Then it waned. By June 1930, it had settled back to a very reasonable 6.3%. Happy days are here again. It was a smash hit of 1930, and for good reason. The Roaring Twenties seemed to have carried right into the next decade. But then something changed. The big government solutions of President Herbert Hoover and later Franklin Delano Roosevelt began to work their black magic. The mood of the economy darkened, and so did the nation's music. In 1931, one of the songs on America's lips was, "I've Got $5." By the next year, it was, "Brother, can you spare a dime?" The answer to that musical question, unfortunately, was a no. Most Americans could not spare a dime. Federal revenues had dropped from $4 billion in 1927 to $1.9 billion in 1932, a decrease of 53% in a matter of just a few years. The economy was in a free fall, and unemployment was again skyrocketing. A crisis of historic proportions had set in. It would take a passionate leader with economic brilliance, clear vision, and a strict adherence to our founders' values if America was to recover quickly. Unfortunately, we got Herbert Hoover instead.
Engineering a Depression. Herbert Hoover was an engineer turned president who believed in the power of planning. He was a tinkerer. Just poke at a problem long enough, and you can solve it. Like Woodrow Wilson, Hoover also believed in the power of the cognitive elite to solve society's ills. Before he was elected president, Hoover had helped to feed the people of Belgium in the build-up to World War I. When economic catastrophe came to America, he followed his engineer's impulse and tried to fix the economy through monetary meddling. He hiked tariffs on imported goods, unleashed government spending, spearheaded new social programs, and championed massive tax increases. The top rate went from 24 to 63% during his administration. He did all of this with the best of intentions and the worst of results. In addition to the 1932 tax hike, Hoover also put in place new taxes that reeked of desperation, like, for example, an excise tax on writing checks. Not surprisingly, the uneducated masses found a way around this brilliant tax by racing to their banks and grabbing their cash. The consequence of this run was that many banks had to be closed down to keep depositors from draining all their reserves. America paid heavily for this and Hoover's other equally disastrous policies. Our deficit, which was $462 million in 1931, jumped to $2.7 billion just a year later. In a way, Hoover was the grandfather of the New Deal. As the famous progressive newspaperman Walter Lippmann wrote in a 1935 column, the policy initiated by President Hoover in the autumn of 1929 was utterly unprecedented in American history. The national government undertook to make the whole economic order operate prosperously. The Roosevelt measures are a continuous evolution of the Hoover measures. In 1932, the deficit remained over $2.5 billion, and Americans were getting desperate. The only light at the end of the tunnel seemed to be the upcoming presidential election in the fall. It would pit politics-as-usual Hoover against the reform candidate, New York Governor Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who promised to give American families a new deal with the government. FDR won in a landslide, 472 electoral votes to 59, and Americans celebrated what they thought would be a quick end to their economic misery. Little did they know that it was only just beginning. Change we can believe in. With Hoover's failures so obvious, the backlash that America is so famous for should have been in full effect. Lower taxes, less spending, freer markets, more individual liberty. But instead of breaking from Hoover's disastrous schemes, FDR expanded them. While Roosevelt wasn't an engineer like Hoover, he had the same mindset, believing that central planning and massive government spending could solve virtually any problem. It was a view that both political parties had fallen prey to, and one that, incredibly, still persists today among many progressive economists, despite the overwhelming evidence that it doesn't work. That FDR would double down on Hoover's policies was somewhat surprising, considering the way he'd presented himself to the public. Throughout the 1932 campaign, Roosevelt had hammered Hoover for his economic errors. "Too often," said candidate Roosevelt, "liberal governments have been wrecked on the rocks of loose fiscal policy." Everywhere he went, Roosevelt billed himself as the common-sense, fiscally prudent choice. In a July 1932 radio address to the nation, still as a candidate, he said, "Let us have the courage to stop borrowing to meet continuing deficits. Revenues must cover expenditures by one means or another. Any government, like any family, can for a year spend a little more than it earns. But you know, and I know, that a continuation of that habit means the poorhouse." Accountability alert! FDR took office in 1933, so if we say that his first real budget was 1934, he can claim responsibility for only spending $3.6 billion more than he took in. It's also interesting to note that over FDR's 12 years in office, he never ran a surplus. Never. Stop borrowing? Cover our expenditures? The poorhouse? These kinds of warnings were nowhere to be found once FDR took office. In fact, if he'd followed his own advice, this might be a completely different kind of chapter. The 1934 election swept 322 Democrats into the House, compared with just 103 Republicans. With huge Democrat majorities in both chambers, Roosevelt's big government wishes became Congress's commands, and his spending spree went forward virtually unchecked. Anything he asked for, he got. The result was predictable and catastrophic. FDR inherited a debt of $22.5 billion in 1933, $374 billion in today's dollars, and nearly doubled it in just 7 years. Throughout his four-term presidency, America liked FDR so much that the term limit amendment to the Constitution was ratified upon his departure. Roosevelt operated under the assumption that there was a direct correlation between government spending and the amount of good the government could do. The more government spent and intervened, the more positive benefits it could spread among society. The New Dealers shared John Dewey's conviction that organized social intelligence could shape society, wrote one noted historian. It was all an effort to reflect the hope of the social gospel of creating a kingdom of God on earth. Needless to say, unless God was hoping to create a nearly bankrupt kingdom full of unemployed, hungry, desperate people, their efforts failed miserably. Smith-boating Adam Smith. As a young man educated at Groton, Roosevelt had been indoctrinated with the seductions of the social gospel. He'd been taught that poverty was unfair, and that it was the government's job to redeem individuals by standing with the poor over the rich, the laborer over the capitalist. In fact, as FDR saw it, the true culprit of the Great Depression had been the lure of profit caused by unscrupulous money changers. The problem for FDR was that the lure of profit was still a beloved concept to most Americans. Free market capitalism had been the rule since the days when our founders were inspired by Adam Smith. Changing public perception about it would not be easy. But FDR was up to the challenge. What he needed, he soon realized, was a respected person who could be the face of a new way to think about government and money. He found his man in the form of a British economic philosopher named John Maynard Keynes. Put simply, Keynes believed that savings was akin to hoarding and greed. He believed that balancing budgets by paying down debts quickly was both unnecessary and counterproductive, and he mocked what he saw as the cult of savings. The morals, the politics, the literature, and the religion of the 19th century joined in a grand conspiracy for the promotion of savings, said Keynes. God and mammon were reconciled. Peace on earth to men of good means. A rich man could, after all, enter into the kingdom of heaven if only he saved. Keynes flatly rejected America's long-standing tradition of savings and frugality. Instead, he argued that the sole objective of all economic activity was consumption. The solution to digging out of economic holes, Keynes believed, was simple. Spending. Lots and lots of spending. The sheer illogic of Keynes's economic philosophy is hard to capture in words. Journalist and economist Henry Hazlitt came close, however. How marvelous is the Keynesian world! The more you spend, the more you have. The more you eat your cake, the more cake to eat. Most people scratch their heads when trying to understand how Keynes justified the idea that a nation could spend itself into prosperity. But he actually addressed that very question himself in a 1934 Red Book article, conveniently titled, Can America Spend Its Way into Recovery? His response? Why, obviously. No one of common sense could doubt it unless his mind had first been muddled by a sound financier or an orthodox economist. By sound and orthodox, he was really referring to people who believed in the founders' principles on money management. Live frugally, spend rationally, save fervently. It was all part of the plan to tarnish those ideas as antiquated or out of touch with the new reality. After all, the founders had never lived through a depression. Keynes explained that the most important thing was to get the money spent. What specifically it was spent on mattered little. It's a view that has persisted in almost every economic downturn America has been through, including the most recent one. Keynes's pseudo-intellectual drivel went on to say that the behavior that would make a man poor, spending more than he earns, could make a nation wealthy. Solid logic, if you ask me. Keynes argued that individuals and nations are economically very different. An individual has to borrow from someone else, but a nation, on the other hand, can borrow from itself. Like a child borrowing from his parents, the overall debits and credits cancel each other out. Put simply, Keynes believed that national debt, which had long been seen by those old-school orthodox economists as sometimes necessary but almost always undesired, doesn't really matter. Stuart Chase, a Keynesian economist, captured this view well. If the national debt is all internal, as ours is, the nation can hardly go bankrupt. The American people are on both sides of the balance sheet. It's magic! Keynes's theory was seductive because it allowed politicians to link their personal ambitions to the idea that spending money was good for the economy. As former Treasury official Bruce Bartlett put it, thanks to the economics of Lord Keynes, the Democrats could buy their votes with an absolutely clear conscience in the genuine belief that deficits were good for the economy. This allowed them to, in effect, promise the people something for nothing. They could have all the new government programs they wanted, and it would not cost a dime because they were paid for with deficits rather than taxes. ADD moment. If it's true that we simply owe all of this money to ourselves, then we should be able to pay ourselves back. Of course, that part of the equation is never brought up because it would essentially require every debt holder to agree to a one-time final payment of pennies on the dollar in exchange for canceling their bonds. That's probably not going to happen anytime soon. A New Deal for Socialism. As their embracing of Keynes shows, FDR's wise men believed capitalism was discredited and at fault for the nation's economic woes. Political theorist James Pontusso, who has studied FDR and the New Deal extensively, found that FDR eventually believed that economic collapse was a byproduct of capitalism. Roosevelt, Pontusso explained, came to doubt the efficacy of an economy made up of small entrepreneurs and businesses. Part of FDR's solution was to link economic security for all Americans to the Constitution, an idea that our founders never contemplated. To accomplish that, the free market system itself would need to be modified. Capitalism, with its focus on individual wealth, could not secure a bright future for all, but the government could. It was a classic rights of man versus rights of men battle, and FDR chose to fight for the so-called greater good. As Rexford Tugwell, a member of Roosevelt's brain trust and Assistant Secretary of Agriculture, declared, "The jig is up. The cat is out of the bag. There is no invisible hand. There never was. We must now supply a real and visible guiding hand to do the task which that mythical, non-existent, invisible agency was supposed to perform, but never did." Despite how it might look in retrospect, there was far from universal agreement that Keynesianism would actually work. Many saw the illogical nature of it and spoke out. For example, George Humphrey, who became Eisenhower's Secretary of the Treasury, saw how silly and dangerous it all was. "I do not think that you can spend yourself rich," he said. Likewise, eminent economists such as Ludwig von Mises saw Keynes as the Santa Claus fable raised to the dignity of an economic doctrine. The problem was that economists who wanted to talk sense into people were fighting an uphill battle. The perception at the time, even among reasonable people, was that fascism had worked in Italy and was beginning to work in Germany as well. Hitler seemed to have the economy on the road to recovery. It was only in retrospect that people realized that their economic statistics were being enhanced by a rapid military buildup, along with the acquisition of wealth from the countries they were invading. As so often happens in politics, the allure of a policy can trump the reality of it. Even though Americans inherently believe that if something sounds too good to be true, it probably is, that rule is tough to remember when supposedly free money is staring you in the face. Precious metals, worthless paper. With Keynes providing the cover, there was only one obstacle standing in the way of Roosevelt's unleashing an avalanche of spending. America was the only country left on the gold standard. This meant, for example, that a Frenchman could convert dollars into gold, but an American living in France could not convert francs into gold. The result was that foreign currency flowed into the United States while gold flowed out, thereby draining our bank's reserves and creating anxiety among investors. So, just weeks into his first term, FDR ended the requirement that U.S. dollars be converted into gold upon request. That move took America off the gold standard, likely saved our banking system, and forever changed our economic course. If he had stopped there, we might look back and applaud FDR for making a rare, sensible decision. But he didn't. Instead, FDR issued an executive order forcing Americans to surrender their physical gold to the U.S. government in exchange for dollars. Why did he do it? It's possible that his rationale was to ensure that private gold, which would have increased in price with U.S. gold out of circulation, wouldn't become an alternative currency. But it's just as possible that he had a dream about confiscating gold and thought it sounded like a pretty good idea. Throwing darts. Ditching Adam Smith's tenet of allowing the marketplace to set prices, FDR and his team pursued a reckless course of price setting. Worse, the price setting seemed to be arbitrary, as though throwing a dart at a dartboard were an adequate substitute for sound economics. Henry Morgenthau, Roosevelt's Treasury Secretary, recalled that on November 3, 1933, he suggested that the price of gold should rise by 19 to 22 cents. FDR wanted the price rise to be 21 cents. The reason? It is a lucky number, he said, because it's 3 times 7. Even Morgenthau seemed shaken about the way decisions were being made. As he later wrote in his diary, if anybody ever knew how we really set the gold price through a combination of lucky numbers, etc., I think they would be frightened. If the public would be frightened over the use of lucky numbers, imagine how they would have felt knowing how little faith FDR had in his own policies. Much of it was little more than guesswork and stabs in the dark. As he later admitted, it is common sense to take a method and try it. If it fails, admit it frankly and try another. But above all, try something. Despite his campaign promises, Roosevelt saw the nation's economic instability as an opportunity to permanently expand the size and power of government, and his trial-and-error method of governing always pushed in that direction. As Morgenthau put it, a number of high-ranking officials in the Roosevelt administration wanted to transform spending from a temporary expedient to a permanent instrument of government. Economist Thomas Sowell has pointed out that while Hoover was content to just throw money at problems and tinker, FDR's actions created lasting structures laced with inevitable consequences. The New Deal administration not only set up policies to deal with existing economic problems of the 1930s, writes Sowell, it set up enduring institutions to change the way the American economy operated. For example, as historian Arthur Schlesinger Jr. has noted, one objective of New Deal power policy was to enlarge the publicly owned sector of the power industry as a means of diminishing private control over the necessities of life. Teachable moment. The most transformative progressives are able to use legitimate emergencies to further both their short and long-term agendas. With FDR, the Great Depression provided a great excuse to push forward many of the things that would have otherwise only been pipe dreams. But FDR knew that temporary wins wouldn't be enough. His real goal was to pass legislation that would continually and automatically bestow gifts to the public. Gifts that people would associate with Democrats, thereby keeping them in power. We see the same kind of progressive thinking again today as the Obama administration uses legislation like TARP, financial regulation, and health care reform, all passed under the guise of various emergencies, to set up new agencies and departments that will again change the way America operates, and in their minds, vote, for decades to come. The difference this time around is that many of us are onto their game. The final reveal. The economic struggles most individuals encountered throughout the Great Depression and its aftermath provided Roosevelt with a golden window of opportunity to leverage economic fears and redefine governmental powers in ways the founders never envisioned. Remember, the invisible hand was a fraud. What people needed was the strong arm of government to make economic security a reality. It was during this window that FDR finally revealed what his ultimate goal really was, a second Bill of Rights. The proposed provisions included the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation, the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return that will give him and his family a decent living, the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad, the right of every family to a decent home, the right of adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health, the right to a good education. While a decent home is still a privilege and not a right, many people have not let go of FDR's utopian vision. Obama advisor and regulatory czar Cass Sunstein has even written a book called The Second Bill of Rights, FDR's Unfinished Revolution and Why We Need It More Than Ever. In many respects, the Second Bill of Rights, proposed in 1944, was not so much an addition to the original, but a replacement of it. Remember the themes that FDR was promoting. Capitalism is evil. The founders hadn't adequately prepared us for a depression, and the Constitution led the American people to the condition they now found themselves in. Change was necessary. The government would drive it. In retrospect, this wasn't reform at all. It was a federal takeover of the responsibilities of everyday life that sought to redefine the public's relationship with government. Here's how New York Times best-selling financial journalist Bill Bonner, founder of the financial firm Agora Incorporated, described it. The new Bill of Rights bound ordinary citizens to the federal government in a way that had not been imagined by the founding fathers. People came to rely on the state for their daily bread and to take a much keener interest in the state itself. Traditional virtues, thrift, independence, self-reliance, were replaced with new virtues, political activism, and gaming the system. In the second Roosevelt era, people came to expect the state to take care of things at home. With American incomes depleted and jobs scarce, many individuals unwittingly embraced the government-as-nanny state model. And who could blame them? Economic pressures were squeezing families from all sides. This was about putting bread on your children's plate, not some ideological debate. The public believed that these were temporary measures meant to stop the bleeding, not a permanent takeover of the American economy. What Americans were not told, of course, was that the goal for some New Dealers was not economic recovery at all, but economic transformation. Walter Lippmann said the New Dealers